entertainment.ie.
I love the way you say film.
Hello and welcome back to The Film Show. I'm your host, Owen Ronayne. With me, as always, Brian Lloyd and Dee Malumbi. It's become a bit of a script, hasn't it, that first sentence?
It is.
Yeah, but, you know, you want a consistent intro,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a consistent product. Yeah. Also, it means that if people are trying to find specific episodes...
Sure.
It just acts as a little bit of camouflage so that they have to delve in.
That they can be like, is this the episode I want to hear? And it's like, no, it's not.
Although the titles are very self-explanatory.
I feel like they are. I feel like we're kind of like, you know, you can't really mess this up. Like, you know that kind of way? As in, like, it's there. It's right there in the title.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have a jam-packed episode.
That was our pre-show.
It comes back to this.
The pre-show banter. But, like, to be honest, like, I'm actually starving right now, so I want to get this done.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
You're hungry.
Oh, yeah, I haven't had lunch either.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm like Hank Marvin here.
I had a bit of a bolognese.
Yeah,
let
you
me
always
describe it to you.
I've seen one. You bring in, like, I hate it. Like, I love it because it smells lovely, but you always bring in this, like, really well-made bolognese situation.
Yeah,
like, it's
yeah.
It's very, like, smelly and lovely.
It takes a bit of forethought.
It does.
You just have to make that rule where you're making dinner, that's your lunch.
That's it, the pre-packing thing, yeah, because like my girlfriend, well, my fiance, I should say, she does that all the time. I can say that.
Yeah,
but she
authority.
Does. But she does it all the time now where she like meal preps and she's vegan, like, so she
doesn't get you in on it.
But she's vegan, like.
Yeah, but you can eat
veg. No, this is a source point. Don't mention this, okay? Don't mention this.
You're vegan. I can't eat that stuff.
You can make bolognese. Like,
the lowest common denominator.
You can, yeah. But like, you can actually, that corn mince is lovely. I will say that. But you need like a very strong sauce. This is now a cooking show. This is no longer a film show. This is a cooking show.
You need a strong sauce.
You do.
To eat the vegetable.
No. Like, It tastes normal. Like, it tastes like mince. Like, you wouldn't know it was non-meat mince.
It is.
Like,
it is very good.
It's it is quite
absorbent.
Good.
Absorbent.
Like, yeah, absorbent. Yeah, exactly. Like,
takes
sauce.
On the profile of the meal.
It does. It does. Like, and
well,
it's
did you have a very meaty household? This is.
Oh, God, growing up. Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Like, oh, yeah, really. Yeah, like, really, really. And, like, it's only, like, in the last, like...
We're going to turn off all vegans and vegetarians. Who are
no, like, I mean,
right
I've done... No, hang on. I've done it. Like, I've gone vegan. I went vegan for a month, like...
And you're pro-meat. You should write down Brian equals animal slaughter. Brian.
Hang on. You eat meat all the time. You're...
I know, I like meat.
Yeah, so what are you fucking giving me shit for?
I'll just put hypocrite. Which could be in every
that
episode.
Could be in everything. That's like that's a garden. That's an evergreen note right there. That is.
Oh, God.
Charlotte, actually, are you a vegetarian?
I was for a
producer
while.
Charlotte,
I remember you
while,
being vegetarian. Yeah.
I couldn't keep up.
Yeah, that's fair.
I like that I'm relaying what you're saying because you're not mic'd. It makes for a weird dynamic.
But the mics are loud enough, I feel, that we can catch.
Not if I'm talking over.
That's true.
Repeating what she's saying. Okay, I'm going to list out what we have in store today because it actually is very legit. We have the review of The Lighthouse, which I've been looking forward to hearing from you guys a lot. I don't know how weird it's going to get. We have a Robert Pattinson interview, which references The Lighthouse Cinema, which is very good.
Yep.
Dublin Shout. We have A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood starring Tom Hanks. We've all seen that.
Yeah.
Might be a first.
We all seen that, yeah.
Ever on I mean, we all see all the films. Come on.
No, I think there was one. We did. That happened once before. We'd actually seen all three. What was that?
Joker, probably, was it?
Joker, I think
Joker,
it was.
Yeah,
it's pathetically low amount, but it should make for a good chat.
Yeah, I think so.
We have Richard Jewell with an interview with its star, Paul Walter Hauser.
Mm-hmm.
That as well, I'm really intrigued to find out. It's a good podcast.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm surprised at your review, actually. We'll talk about that.
Oh, I don't know whether to be disappointed.
I thought it was a good review. I write excellently, Brian.
I know you do. I did. I never doubted it for a second. I'm just surprised at the score you gave it.
Did
I'm
you
gonna
read
write
it?
Clint Eastwood, because we rarely talk about him, and there's a lot to say.
Yeah, there is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're never going to mention him in this episode. And The Turning, we've got interviews with Finn Wolfhard and Brooklyn Prince.
Jeez, it is a packed show.
Yeah, it's a good show.
Good show.
Good show.
Great podcast. Okay, we're going to go straight into a little bit of news.
Movie news.
That's right, news.
News.
Movie news.
Movie news. We have got three half stories here that we're going to refuse to spend a lot of time on because we have a lot to get through. So, up first, Matrix 4 has begun production today.
No,
that's next month. And then The Batman has started production since yesterday. Yes. Like officially.
Oh, so wait.
Yeah.
When's Matrix 4 happening?
Next month.
Okay. And when's The Batman started production?
So today. Officially yesterday.
And what date is it today?
Oh, this week, I mean, because I don't know when this show is going out. So let's just say this week to be safe.
Well, it happened on Monday. Yeah. Monday of this week.
Yeah.
It began production. Although, like, I mean, there was like set photos like a couple of weeks ago.
I know, yeah. Like Colin Farrell, but yeah. I suppose it's the first official word on it.
Does he look Tubbs? Does he look penguin-y?
He's
all like grey haired.
Yeah,
he?
He's got grey hair.
Are they going to make him like badass or something?
I don't know. Like, he's looking a bit beefy.
I'll
say that. And like when he was on Jimmy
Kimmel. He was looking a bit beefy on Kimmel, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When he was talking.
Didn't help that he was shilling Abracababra.
Abracababra either. Like, I tell you, if ever there is a man who has fucking earned his gold card or black card from Abracababra, it is Colin Farrell. Fair dues.
Yeah.
I give him credit. Because like most people, like when you get the free shit, you're like, oh yeah, thanks, that's it. And you never mention
maybe
him again.
An Instagram post. And
as in he's their like.
He is their ambassador.
He's their PR department.
He's going on international American television. Just touting
Abracababra. And to be fair, I am a fan of Abracababra. I do enjoy a good Abracababra.
It's a good restaurant.
It's a great restaurant. But I will say though,
send
that,
us
like,
a gold card.
Can we get a film show? We'll share it
equally.
Yeah, we could do that.
Do you know what else? I don't know if you
lunchtime will never be an issue again.
Yay! I don't know if you guys did this, but I paused the video when he was looking at the Abracababra card just to have a good look at it.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
it was issued from the Rath Mines.
Oh,
Abracababra.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder, is that like, because it's a tiny Abracababra there, so is that their HQ or is that his local?
Who knows?
I don't know. Is there an Abracababra in Castleknock?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
That's what I would have said. Like,
but does he even live there? I don't know.
I don't know.
We need to get his full address.
Colin
dress
Farrell.
Dress up as Abracababra guy.
And just be like, you know, like rock up, like pretending we're a Deliveroo and just be like, oh, I've got your Abracababra right here, Colin Farrell.
He might work it into the Batman even.
Yeah.
Taco fried. I can't do it. Tee up impressions I don't want to do. I always just look to you going like, fill the gap.
Fill the gap. No, I can do a Burgess Meredith penguin very well. Like, it's like, rah, rah, rah. Because it's just like, it's, oh, my little friend.
Rah, rah. I can't hear Charlotte's voice, but I can hear her roll in the eyes as she adjusts the volume.
I'm very sorry. I'm very, very sorry. I always feel bad when I get shouty. Because I know... You have to listen to this. And the people at home.
Squawking like a
fucking penguin trying to do Burgess Meredith. Like, jeez.
And that's our 1 minute on the Batman.
Yay! We got to the minute.
Star Wars Episode 9, Duel of the Fates, was the alternative title for it. And there was a leaked script. And Colin Trevorrow has announced that that was indeed a real leak. And there's concept art. And that was true as well.
I literally do not care.
I know.
Genuinely couldn't care less.
We actually
like,
need
reading
to balance
about it, like, I was like, I don't care. I mean, it's interesting, I guess, that it's significantly different to the end product, but both are kind of crap and fan pandering. So I don't care. I do not care for Star Wars
That's
any
fair.
Longer.
Do you think, is there any world in which you would have been swung around by Episode 9 if it had, like, stayed true to Rian Johnson's thing and actually carved out a bit of cinema for itself?
If it had been a bit more interesting and unpredictable and good.
So you're going to read the full
then.
Alternative spec script and see. No, that's fair. Brian?
I don't.
Do you mourn what could have been?
No, actually, I don't, to be honest. I mean, I think it's just one of those things
because
where it's like,
you're a Star Wars fan and Star Wars can do no wrong.
If I may.
She might have you there.
Deirdre. That is true. I will give you credit. That may be true.
I must circle this hypocrite.
Circle it a couple of times there. Make sure it's real. No, what I will say is that I think the idea of mourning what might have been, I mean, that is just such like, you know, the people that are keeping the fucking Snyder cut of Justice League going.
Yeah, fair. Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, the last thing I want is for it to turn into that fucking situation.
Mm.
Like, I am fine that I didn't get to see Colin Trevor's version of it. So whatever. What I'm more kind of what I was more tickled about, and kind of half the reason why I actually sort of covered this, was because there was a few people on Facebook who were basically saying, oh no, that leak is bullshit.
Oh yeah, you got into a whole fight.
And I got into a fight with people on Facebook about, no. about yeah, when the leak...
under the entertainment.ie moniker?
No, I didn't.
No.
I made sure that this was on my personal account just to fucking argue with these
and
people.
And is your byline on it?
Yeah, oh, yeah, of
I
course
love
it is.
This.
Oh yeah, yeah,
the
no.
The journalist pops up in the comments.
To just like smack people around the place. Oh yeah, no, no, I came fully prepared.
They must have been shaking in their boots.
Oh, I was spoiling for a fight.
Like referencing links and stuff like this.
I was saying these leaks are true, basically.
Yeah, as in, but what had happened was that when the leak came out, AV Club and Entertainment Weekly had both independently verified that it was correct.
Then they must have connects and so on.
Of course, yeah. Then Collider came in and actually said, yeah, it's true. Not only that, we've got concept art as well. This is all real. And a couple of people in the Facebook comments were basically saying, oh, no, 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 that's bullshit. That's bullshit. And I said, no, this is real. These outlets all verified it. I would trust every single one of those verified. And then he was like, no, 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 it's this screenshot from like 6 months ago, and was like, duh, he said that this leak wasn't real. I was like, no, he was talking about a different draft. That was a draft. Oh no, like
there was like a proper back and forth.
Yeah.
If you care to find it on Facebook, it's quite entertaining.
Yeah, it is.
And if you're one of those engaged, interactive, contributing commenters, I want you to unsubscribe from the podcast. Get off entertainment.
Get the shit out of here. Don't ever come at me thinking that I don't do
Take
my
your
job.
Debate and you engagement can, you, out of here.
just get out of here. Just get, like, don't ever come question me about my fucking work, okay? I live here. Don't ever fucking question me about this shit, all right?
And that's our X amount of time on Star Wars. Tell me something about The Matrix 4, but make it 10 seconds.
One thing that was kind of interesting was that Hugo Weaving confirmed he's officially not back as Agent Smith, which is quite disappointing, especially because it was given to something as simple as scheduling conflicts, you know? So basically, he'd been in talks with Lena Wachowski about starring in the film for a while.
Yeah.
There kept on being delays. He wasn't being given an official date. And in the meantime, obviously, working actor, looking for other work. Yeah, so he agreed to be in this play that he's currently promoting. And that's why there's the scheduling conflict, because now this is entering production next month.
Right.
I thought that was a bit disappointing.
Where, you know, obviously, he owns that character. He's given so much of it. If the actor is willing, is it up to the product? Like, obviously, whatever. It's all just money, so they're not going to stall it. But do they owe him anything?
I don't think they do. And to be honest, I think if he wanted to, I'm sure he could have
really
pushed that play back and done it. Do you know, like, anyway, like, I think it's sort of like saying, oh, no, I'm busy. I'm doing a play.
Yeah.
I can't do this. I'm sorry. Like, I mean... we talked to him. Do you remember when we were when he was over?
He actually was over and we had a chat with him.
We had him in the show.
I got to meet him as well.
Yeah, you were there. Of course you were.
He was over for Black 47.
Cool, yeah.
And we were, I was asking him.
He's such a tall man. Oh my God. Tall.
We're all just equally name dropping to each other now because we're all just like, we're all there as well.
I was there.
He was really good.
He was really cool.
He was so cool. But like.
And actually,
No, just the point I was going to make was that he is the most least career-driven actor I think I've ever met.
He was talking about theatre and he was talking about...
Yeah, he talked about theatre. He talked about all his kind
motivation.
Of like... Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And like, money is not this man's god, nor is his career. He's very much kind of like, if this has artistic intent, if I can...
He wants the work.
Connect, yeah, the work. Like, that's it. Mm. Like, he was like over there shilling for Black 47, which... Might have been a big film in Ireland, but outside of here, like, it wasn't that well known.
Yeah.
And again, more dropping. When I was doing the junket for The Mortal Engines, it was Hugo Weaving and Stephen Lang were together. And I said, I was talking to Stephen Lang. I was
Black Box Theatre.
Yeah, I were talking about Black Box Theatre. And I was also like, look, you should really watch Black 47. It's basically like Outlaw Josie Wales. And Hugo Weaving's like, oh yeah, that's a really good description. And he was like, oh, I haven't seen it. And he was like, you should watch it. It's really good.
I'll
so my point is that if Hugo Weaving cares about something, he will go to it.
That's yes, yeah, no, that's fair, really
and
good
I think
point.
that's why he picked the play over just another Matrix movie. I would say he cares about the money a little because in the same interview where he said, "No, I'm not involved with the Matrix," he also revealed that the reason he didn't come back to the Marvelverse was because of money. So he was supposed to get. He was told that he was going to get an increasing, basically, salary following Captain America. And he knew at this point he wasn't going to be in the Winter Soldier, but he knew he'd appear again. And
yeah,
his,
he was huge in the first one.
Yeah, exactly. And what he was offered accumulatively, so for Endgame and Infinity War together, was less than what he got for Captain America. And he was like, well, screw that.
Right.
Basically. Which is totally fair enough.
I thought he did come back.
No, he didn't.
Was that recast?
Recast.
It was recast.
No way. Yeah, which filmed me. Which I... it was such a small part. Yeah. I wonder, was it reduced due to that?
Could have been, yeah. I mean, I completely fumbled in our interview with him. I can say it now because it's been so long.
Was it cut out? We cut it out.
We cut it out. So here's a special behind the scenes fact. No. But I started asking him about Infinity War and Brian like said to me, so this is all in the middle of the interview. He's not in. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And I managed to move on quite quickly, but in my head, I was so embarrassed. But
your
like, even when
fire.
We were, even when we were leaving, when Hugo Weaving was leaving, he kind of like, I kind of said, I'm really sorry again. And he just gave me like this smile, like he did not mind at all. And
he's
like
been
that,
asked it and he,
that
yeah.
completely made my day. Like he was just such a pro about it, like didn't take it offensively or anything. He was just like,
yeah. There you go. Jeez, yeah, right. Really so it nice. Is a shame. Yeah. Like
I remember that, and I remember
this has
like,
turned into Hugo Weaving Frank.
But he was really nice. No, he was.
No, the thing is,
he was
lovely. Such a cool,
he was
nice
so
guy.
Fucking cool.
But no, as an actor, he does improve everything he's in. I think.
Yeah,
I've seen him. What was the one where he plays an abused at the Oranges and Sunshine one or whatever?
Yes,
he's amazing in that.
Yeah, he's a really like. I mean, even go back to something like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah, and I nerded out about that at the end, and he was totally cool with like talking about it because you get some actors who are like, "Oh, I don't want to talk about
my
past." My 90s
work.
Rupert Everett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was him.
What was he refusing to talk about?
Ah, we won't get into it.
Oh,
for one for later. But, no, like yeah, no, Hugo.
Those poor listeners.
No, it's basically I was asking about my best friend's wedding and he just was
shut down.
Yeah, he just didn't want to talk about it.
Jesus.
Which is a shame because like, I mean, it is kind of his biggest movie.
It is.
He should get back to it.
My best friend's wedding too.
What I will say about The Matrix is that as a character, I don't think Agent Smith needs to be played by an older Hugo Weaving. And I kind of think that might take away from it for me.
They'll probably have a new antagonist. I don't think they're going to do the Agent Smith thing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that first trilogy was all about him. So it wouldn't really make sense to recast the character, I don't think.
And, like, plus as well, the idea, as I recall from the first one, was that the agents were basically interchangeable. Like
exactly, yeah. You know, but he was one's rogue program.
Yeah, that was it. Like, they were all just, like, you know, had the glasses and the suits and they're all just, you know, like, so it didn't, okay, fine, he was a rogue program that was, like, the opposite end of the equation of Neo and stuff.
I would love to run a listener competition where people have to send in, they've got 30 seconds to explain the plot to the third Matrix.
Oh my God.
I'm trying to even remember, was the Agent Smith to do
with... I remember the shot where Neo finds out Trinity's dead, and it's really funny because he's like talking to her and then it just pans out and she's been stabbed and he's blind so he doesn't notice, and there's something kind of comical about it. And it's like a really serious moment and it looks hilarious. Like it looks like something you would see in a Monty Python movie.
Yeah, the zoom.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's visual comedy. Okay, we're going to dive straight into movie reviews.
Movie reviews.
So The Lighthouse has been on the radar for a long time because even the first trailer, is it a bit mental or what?
I think this film... Dee, I don't know how you feel about it, but I watched this and I came out of it with the same kind of vibe as Mandy, which is this film is absolutely batshit, but if you can buy into it, it's fucking brilliant. Like, I gave this 5 stars.
Right.
It's the first one I've given this year. The minute it was over, I was like, I need to talk to everybody about this film. Because I need to pull it apart. I don't even need to pull it apart. I'm just be like, did you see that shit? Oh my God, that film was fucking insane. Like, So I've really been looking forward to this.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Although I was getting more Mother vibes from it than
really?
The Lighthouse. Yeah.
Why Mother?
Because,
is it that abstract? Is it
because
like,
it's very abstract?
Is
yeah,
there?
Yeah.
Give me the synopsis as it stands. I have a feeling it might veer away from.
Oh, like very simply, it's basically these two lighthouse keepers. One is kind of, you know, has been there for a good while.
Yeah.
That's Willem Dafoe, and then Robert Pattinson is the newbie, and they're stranded on this island when this big storm comes, okay. And they gradually descend into drunkenness and madness. I brought my notes because
ooh.
I write down some interesting things.
So these mid watching.
So these
notes?
Are mid watching it.
Good God.
So yeah, I was reading back over them and I thought they were quite amusing. So I thought that I'd read them out to you. So
frightened.
I have descent into madness and obsession.
Sure.
Beguiling. Defoe always farting. Pattinson
yes.
often smoking. Almost comical. Almost frightening. Defoe is basically that pirate narrator from SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yes. Are you ready, kids?
At one point, I just write, this is one trippy movie. There is a lot of masturbating, farting, and shitting in this movie.
Yes. Wow. Yeah. The big three.
Yeah, right.
Getting,
all at the same time.
Getting drunk scenes and weird mermaid sex and dead bird images.
Okay.
So yeah, it's got it all.
It's a real romp.
It's a real romp. Yeah, yeah. Just, yeah, lots of weird nudity and violence against animals. Basically, if you look at its rating on IFCO, it's like high for like
it's
all
got,
of
it's got them.
Them
all.
Yeah.
Like, it's got them
really?
All.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's like, see, that's it. Like, I mean, I always, and
it's
I kind of
provocative.
See, that's it. Because I kind of went into this in when I was writing the review. It's like, you know, if you're the kind of person who watches films all the time, it is the kind of thing that story, everything just kind of blends into one, doesn't it? Like, and it's the sort of thing that you can't really clarify anything. Mm-hmm. When I was watching this, it was the kind of thing of like, this is burned into my brain. I will never forget seeing this for the first time because
it's a palate cleanser.
Yeah, it's just, it's so kind of like forceful and it's so like shocking in every sense of the word. Like, it's in black and white. Mm-hmm. It's only two actors. They're even talking in weird kind of language. Like, it's in that sort of New England pirate Moby Dick Herman Melville-esque kind of thing. The fact that there are like birds everywhere and some of them are dying, the fact that they're farting and shitting all the time, like, it's so forceful. It is so like goes right through the screen and like tries to shake you awake from whatever. I loved it. I absolutely fucking loved it, but I fully accept, like, there's no way I would bring my mother or father to see this.
Oh no.
Jesus, no. I'd never.
Actually, my dad would probably find it like,
would he?
And my dad, you know, is a huge, huge fan of Citizen Kane. So that's also why I think he would enjoy this, because this is a very like kind of movie.
Right.
If you know what I mean, it's very cinematic.
It can be all these
you know
things.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is. Yeah. And it's actually at times, even though like it's repulsive, it's also
beautiful.
Gorgeous. Like I can absolutely see why it won for cinematography.
Yeah.
You know?
And what were they trying to do with this?
Why I said Mother, because I'm like, what is this movie actually, what does it actually mean?
Yeah, what's
Do you think it's just incredibly open to interpretation? It's
I
very
think so.
Abstract.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that, I mean, what I kind of took from it was that saying of hell is other people. That's it. The way I took it was these two people were stuck in hell and that hell manifested itself in one another. You know, for Willem Dafoe's character, he was, you know, very much trying to, you know, attune himself to the kind of the repetitiveness of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Robert Pattinson was just trying to, like, understand why he was here and, like, that constant trying to grip on reality, pulling itself away. But really, no. I mean, if you had to sum this up in one sentence, it's hell is other people. That's it. That's what The Lighthouse is. It's two men descending into hell. The hell is themselves. And they rip apart at each other. And, like, it's that thing of, you know, they're like, there's lots of metaphors in it. Like, there's a there's a whole thing where he kills this one-eyed seagull.
Mm-hmm.
And then Willem Dafoe's character tells him, no, you should leave those seagulls alone.
No, he says that before he kills
him. Oh, before he kills it. Sorry.
He's warned not to do it.
Because that's the whole point, isn't
it? Yeah.
That? he's warned not to, and then he does.
And then he does it, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And the idea of, like, you know, do we carry curses with us? Are curses real? And it's just...
Cain and Abel or something?
Cain and Abel, yeah. I mean, like, I was thinking of Waiting for Godot. Like, that's what I was kind of initially like, oh, that's
because even, do they show, like, do they ever elaborate on Robert Pattinson's backstory? Or is it
they
that?
They do.
Yeah, yeah, okay, they right. get into it.
And they rip the piss out of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very Tarkovsky as well.
Ooh,
Andrei Tarkovsky. Yeah. Oh, sure, I said that to you when yeah. it came out of the screening. You're like, oh, that's so wanky. And you're feckin' referencing Waiting for Godot. Like,
yeah, I know,
sake.
That's fair.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
So bullshit.
For all we know, wankers listen to this as well.
Could
so.
Be, yeah.
But I mean, it's also referencing, like, and I would have, like, studied these a lot in college when I did my film studies degree.
No, we knew it was coming out, The Lighthouse. We knew it was on
But
its
I
way.
Mean, like, old, like, silent black and white movies, like yeah. for a lot of this movie they're not even talking, and there is that like aspect ratio of it and everything. Like, it reminded me of this old movie I saw called The Wind, which interestingly enough the ending is supposed to be so this woman is she's just newly married, absolutely adores her husband, but he's constantly going off to work,
right.
and the place where they live, like, the wind is just so constant and so rough and everything that she starts to go mad. Now at the end of the film they actually Hollywoodized it, so they rewrote the ending.
Wow.
Her husband comes home and she, like,
gets over it.
She becomes well again. Yeah, but the original ending was that she wanders off into the storm, into the wind, and is lost and
yeah.
forever.
Mm.
So it reminded me a lot of that film as well. I would have liked to ask Robert Pattinson a bit about it, but I don't think he would
have
gotten
have
the movie
wind?
I was yeah. referencing. Also reminded me, I don't know if you guys have ever seen Man of Iron.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's an old black and white movie. And then just that whole idea of man versus the elements.
Right.
And how
that's all done visually. Like...
Yeah, and how you're never really going to win. I mean, The Lighthouse obviously brings that to much more of an extreme because the storm, like, is kind of like tearing their house down.
Right.
You know?
I have to see this film.
Yeah, more, I think you would enjoy it. I think it's your kind of movie. But yeah, like Brian said, it's not one you'd bring your ma to.
No.
It's an incredible movie. It's really unlike anything I've ever seen, even though there are kind of points of reference
yeah.
that we've noted there. But it's a real kind of cinephiles movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I nearly even say, like, just you're talking about nature there. Like, I'd nearly kind of... It's more than nature. I think it's like it's supernatural because
yeah,
there's a really like big scene in it where, and again, I this is another point that we
well,
haven't
I mean,
touched
there
on.
There is a mermaid. So.
Yeah, there is a mermaid, but there's another
who
like
plays the mermaid.
I don't know actually.
Some
model, like, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
But like, there is a thing about it that it's actually very funny.
Sure.
The film is actually yeah, hilarious. Sure. Like there's a scene in it when Robert Pattinson is talking about his backstory and how he got there. And it's just like, it's Willem Dafoe's character just like, oh, you're on the run, are you? Like, as in like ripping the piss out
yeah,
of.
Yeah, of course.
That kind of like, oh, I left the woods behind because I had to get away. And Willem Dafoe's character is almost like, oh yeah, really? Like
whatever.
You're a fucking cliche kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's a big scene in it where Willem Dafoe's character curses Robert Pattinson's character. And he like invokes fucking Triton, the Greek god of the sea. Like. And it's literally like, it's this big, huge monologue, just like massive, like 5 minute monologue where he like, it's amazing. Like
right.
Willem Dafoe should have won the fucking Oscar there for that. But how it starts is because he says, I hate your cooking. It literally just begins like that. He's like, I fucking hate your cooking. And I'm like, oh, I hate your cooking.
And that just evolves. Into
and it just
monologue.
Evolves. It just gets crazier and crazier and crazier until he literally like calls down Triton to curse Robert Pattinson.
Right,
like.
Yeah.
And it's just that idea of like how stupid it is.
I mean,
the
even
idea that
with all the like
up,
flatulence, yeah. I mean, he just keeps farting in the movie. And like, it is funny. Farts are funny.
Yeah. It's just, and like,
now we're on my page.
And like, I talked to Robert Eggers and he said like, they actually... scripted every single fart.
No way.
That was in the script. That was like fart noise.
That's even better.
Like they actually had like it was down to that minutiae.
Yes,
yeah,
that
yeah.
there was no leaving to chance. Like it was like when it was like fart that was in the script.
And what was he trying to set out with a film like this?
I think it was well he's the way that he explained it to me was that this was basically a tale of madness. That's it. It is how people can drive one another insane. And it's interesting that you mentioned Mother, because like Mother was so fucking allegorical, like, oh, it's about Adam and Eve and creation and Earth. I didn't feel that in this. This just felt more like...
I just feel more that it's open to interpretation. I know that with Mother, in the case of... oh my gosh, what's his name? Director?
Javier Bardem.
No, the director.
Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah, Darren Aronofsky. I'm really frustrated by the fact that he said this means that.
Yeah.
And again, this is probably from my film studies background, but I like the idea of a movie being open to interpretation. And I think, as far as I understand with Eggers so far, he is allowing that space.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Right, it's whatever people get signaled
with. Yeah, exactly.
Or
yeah, yeah. But Mother, like when I first watched it, I loved the fact that it was so open, and I was really annoyed when he subsequently said, oh, it actually means this. Because I had a different idea in my head.
Me too, yeah.
You know, there you
Wrong.
Go.
And it's that, this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think if you're going for that whole kind of artistic thing, then that's like part of your...
You should embrace that.
Yeah, you have to embrace that interpretive nature of art.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like David Lynch does that. Like David Lynch purposely makes these weird films and then he never discusses it. Like, does that kind of meme... Like you always do see, it's like, you know, I think Eraserhead is my most spiritual film. Elaborate on that. No. And like call David Lynch, like he, of course he's going to say, just no, I'm not going to answer that. Like, and like, I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's good when directors are like, look, if you take that from this, fine.
Mm.
I'm not going to discuss what this film is about. I want you, it's more interesting if you tell me what it's about. Like,
and this is probably as mainstream as it gets for something this avant-garde.
That's the thing. It kind of is, because I mean, at its heart, it's really just a psychological horror.
Mm.
Actually, I was talking to Serena Bellissimo from Spin 103.8, and she was going to watch this, and I was like, you know, it's a horror. And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah, you probably shouldn't watch it. Because she's like worse for horrors than me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad that I pre-warned her, because I mean, it's super disturbing. Like that, you know how that last image of it like stays with you. You're like, holy shit.
Sake. Wow.
Yeah. It's so good though. It's so good.
It's
Can you make
good,
it
yeah.
like an artsy date, or will you have huge regrets?
I wouldn't eat before you go in.
I also, yeah, it wouldn't be a first date movie.
No, God, no.
You'd want to know that your date would be willing to watch that, because she'll be like, what the fuck is wrong with you for bringing me to this?
Yeah.
Or he.
I like piss and shit and wank, okay?
Like, I mean, no, to be fair, yeah, like a statement of intent, baby. No, but I will say, like, you have to go into it up for it. Like, that's it. You can't go in and be like, you got to commit to it. Like.
If you feel like leaving... You should probably leave.
Yeah, if you're having second thoughts about it, just don't bother. Because...
Yeah, if you're getting very nervous like halfway through, it's definitely going to get way worse from here.
Like it takes a fucking sharp turn about the halfway way, and just like, all right, fuck it, let's go, let's do it. Like, and again, that goes to Mandy. Like, because Mandy's like, it's kind of getting this, and then it's
So, wow,
I loved it. I fucking loved it. I can't wait to see it.
Was it 5 stars for you, D?
I'm glad I didn't have to review it, because I find this kind of movie really hard to give a star rating to. But I would agree with Brian's 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. Yeah, sweet. Because I can't really... Yeah.
Boil it down to... Yeah.
It's a very powerful movie, for sure. But it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. Yeah.
It really isn't. Like,
I actually really want to get what other people thought of it now. We should start interacting with our listeners someday. Okay, on to A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, another dual actor role.
We all saw this, didn't we?
Yeah.
Is it as provocative as The Lighthouse?
It's definitely different.
Yeah.
It's definitely different.
I mean, again, it's kind of, this is why I'm getting so frustrated by the lack of recognition with female directors, but... Marielle Heller, I think, really elevated this movie.
Absolutely.
And made it so much more than it could have been.
Yeah.
It could have been just a kind of soapy, feel-good kind of movie. And actually, watching the trailers, that's what I thought it was going to be. I was like, okay, here
the
we go. Another
insanely reductive.
Yeah,
there's text every second frame, like, when one man is... Blah, blah, blah.
It's so ridiculous. You think it's just going to be a nicey-nicey Tom Hanks movie, and then you watch it, and it's actually like about, like... mental health and all of these other issues, and kind of questioning, you know, like fatherhood and family and all of these other kind of big issues come into it. And I mean, it's similar to her film, like, Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah.
Like, there's some really, it's very good. Yeah, there's some real kind of poignant moments in it.
There's a lot of similarities in it, I thought, as well. Yeah. Like just the tone or something. The way she deals with actors or something. I don't know what it is.
Exactly. She really directs very well, which is, again, why isn't this stuff being recognized? But yeah, I thought it was really, really much more compelling than I thought it would be. I mean, still kind of left you like hopeful, but also contemplative. And I really liked that about it.
And the character of Mr. Rogers, I think, as well, is so well done. Like, the backstory is that Julie, my fiancée, is from Pittsburgh. And he grew up, Mr. Rogers is from the next town over. And he's a god there. It's insane. I think in his hometown, they've changed all the crossing the street things to his voice.
Oh my god. Really?
Oh wait, no, maybe that's your man from Beautiful Life. I don't know. But whatever. he is so influential there that they have like a museum dedicated to him where they have the full set and everything.
Yeah.
And one thing from this that so after we watched it, the premise is that he's working on an Esquire article about Mr. Rogers and he has to do a profile on him.
Mm.
And then in the third act, they don't actually spend a lot of time going through the article.
No, not
at
all.
But if you've seen the film, it's really worthwhile checking out. There's this 5-page thing and you can see it. And it's so interesting to even be like, oh, so this is what Tom Hanks would have read first when he was trying to get used to the character and stuff like that. Like, they really deal with everything that comes up in the film, but in a kind of new, fresh way.
I think, that's it. Because like, there's such, exactly as you said, Dee, like, I mean, I was watching the trailer and I was like, oh, fuck, here we go. Another fucking
vanilla
Oscar bait biopic drama. Jesus Christ, how many of these have we seen? Mm. Don't get me wrong. I think Tom Hanks is a great actor, but like, come on, like, really? And then when you watch it, it's almost as if like they just had this family drama with Matthew Reese and Chris Cooper and Susan Kalichi Watson. And then they just dropped Fred Rogers into the middle of it.
Yeah.
And then just like stirred it around a bit to make it kind of work. And it works completely because everything you need to know about Fred Rogers, the character, you learn from his interactions with Matthew Reese. You don't need this sort of like...
We don't have any of that baggage anyway.
No, not at all.
He's a god over there, yeah.
No, yeah, that's it. Like, and what I would say as well is the fact that like, because I was watching this, and I imagine it was the same for you as well. Like, I kind of knew who he was. I knew that he was like very well loved. I knew that he had a TV show, but that's really all I needed to know, more or less.
Yeah.
But you come away from it and you're like, wow, he really was a special person. Like, he really did have this just inhuman amount of empathy, like, for people. Like, and like, but at the same time was himself human. Like, he had dark moments. Like, he had these issues. Like, when there's a scene in it where Tom Hanks, as Fred Rogers or Will Rogers or whatever, he says to him, like, you know, yeah, my two sons, like, they really tested me. Like one son just didn't mention who he was to his friends.
Yeah.
And another one...
Your dad's Mr. Rogers.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, that's it. Like, and there's another scene in it where he talks to Fred Rogers' wife and he's like, you know, how is it being married to a living saint? And she's all like, he's not a saint. Like, and you don't even need to... It's not as if you need to see him getting angry or something. You just, it's enough to know that he works on it. That's it. He works on being a good person.
That he's like human. He's not just this kind
of,
you know, perfect God or whatever.
Yeah.
And touching on that scene where they're talking about his sons, I thought it was really interesting when Lloyd Vogel asks Fred Rogers about, was it not really hard for your sons?
Yeah.
And then Fred is kind of talking it out. And he's like, yeah, actually, that's a really good point. It must have been hard for them, as opposed to like it being hard for himself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And even then he's like, so I really appreciate that insight.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. And even the scenes where he's using the puppet Daniel to talk.
Oh, my God. They really get to you.
Yeah, because they really show how abstract it is that basically... There's Mr. Rogers using a puppet to talk to this fully grown man about his emotions.
Yeah. And again,
and how effective it is.
She uses a couple of those shots, the kind of breaking the fourth wall. Like, there's the puppet facing forward and there is this other bit with Fred Rogers, played by Tom Hanks, looking directly into the camera. But it's not cheap. It's there for like a really specific reason.
Yes.
And it really kind of works. And I thought just, I thought the exploration of Lloyd Vogel's character as well as Fred Rogers, like it really, really got to me. You know, you really, really felt for him and how he just couldn't communicate, how he had just these barriers up. He couldn't forgive his father. He couldn't let him back into his life. And he was carrying all these issues. And Fred just kind of gradually like helps him come out of himself. But he has to ultimately make that decision himself. I just thought it ended really up being really, really. Well. Yeah, yeah. By Matthew Rhys as well. Yeah, really, really. There was so much more to it than I expected there to be.
Yeah. And I think what just actually on that scene in the restaurant where they it breaks the fourth wall, that Jesus, that fucking floored me. That did,
yeah,
that really got me. And it's actually based on a real life thing that happened.
Yeah, the Oscars are,
was it the Oscars?
He's getting a lifetime achievement Grammy, maybe.
No, it was an Emmy, I think,
or Emmy even.
Yeah, he was getting a lifetime achievement Emmy, and he literally said that exact same speech where it was like, "Think about someone who loved you into being." I'll watch the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that thing of like that. It, like, I remember, like, the silence of it.
Yes. Yeah,
that they actually commit to it, like.
Yeah. He and commands the room as
it's,
well.
That's it, like. You can just see everyone in the room there.
Yes.
Was sucked in. And you as well, watching it, you're like, wow. Yeah. That's a real moment. Like,
I
so
think
good.
Tom Hanks as well actually deserves a lot of credit because he could have.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, he did earn that Oscar nomination. I'll give it to him.
Yeah, he did. Exactly, Jesus, he did. Yeah.
And he is a proper supporting actor in it, in fairness. I think Matthew Rhys, you'd say, would be the lead. Because some people were like, oh, Tom Hanks is the lead in it. But no, watching it now, I don't think I would say that.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah. It also reminded me a bit of something like The Two Popes and maybe The Lighthouse, where it's just two actors for the most part. Yeah. There's a lot of bells and whistles around it, but it's all just about those monologue scenes or those dialogue scenes.
Yeah, but Chris Cooper, I thought, was turned into a really good performance as well, in fairness. And the actress who played his wife,
Susan Kalichi Watson,
she was very good too.
The awkwardness of those scenes, really good, really worth checking out.
Very, very worth checking out. It's actually a cracking week this week, isn't it?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I also saw the Netflix documentary about
Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Won't You Be My Neighbor? Brilliant. I saw it before I went in, and what I'd say is go check that out after the film if you see the film. And you've got, you'll probably come out with a bit of a Mr. Rogers itch to scratch.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And the documentary's really good. And they interview the guy who Matthew Rhys plays a lot as well.
Yeah, they talk to the Mrs. Rogers as well. Yeah, that was a really good documentary. That was a really, really good documentary.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Right, on to Clint Eastwood. We must talk about him. Tell me all about latest film.
You gave this 3.5 stars, and I'm kind of surprised. Because I'll tell you why. I thought this film was okay.
Right.
I thought it was very okay. I thought it was like a lot of Clint Eastwood's later work, which is, it's very fucking simplistic. It's got a story. It's on rails. It's just bam, 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 going the whole way through it.
Yeah.
But that simplicity, I think, didn't really help. I think this is the story of Richard Jewell and what happened there, I feel, was far more complex than what Clint Eastwood gave it. That gave it that space, if you know what I mean. You know, the whole
Give us a bit of a synopsis.
So essentially what it is, it's about the Atlanta Olympics bombing. Richard Jewell, who's played by Paul Walter Hauser, is this very earnest to the point of it being like problematic. Like, he's just very full on guy.
Is he a bit of a simple guy in it?
He's kind of simple.
Yeah, he is kind of a bit simple. Yeah, but he desperately wants to be a police officer. But, you know, he can't fit the bill, and he, you know, flunks out of, or not that he flunks out, he's not able to get through the entrance exam and stuff like that, so he's working as a security guard.
Yeah.
And he's just very, very overzealous, and like, people kind of make fun of him for being overzealous. And all while this is happening, there's a bomb threat in the Atlanta Olympics, and the FBI are sent down, led by John Hamm, to kind of keep scoping out the area. Richard Jewell discovers the bomb.
Yeah.
He essentially is hailed as a hero because he saved some lives from moving them all away and stuff like that. But then it becomes a thing of, like, the FBI basically work up this idea that maybe he actually planted the bomb, because apparently,
is it just a lack of leads or what? They actually
it's
just
a lack of leads,
tight,
and it's sort of thing of like, how did he manage to find that, like,
so quick or whatever?
Yeah. And then it becomes a thing about...
There'd also been this kind of... Like, there'd been a few, they called them false heroes around the time. Yeah. So the idea was there were people in kind of professional areas who were setting up these incidents and then discovering them or whatever. Like, they cited a fireman who started a fire and then, saved everyone from the fire.
Wow,
so there'd been
right.
a pattern of these things happening.
In that era or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It's a funny
yeah.
story for Clint Eastwood to... What's he trying to say with these characters?
Well, that's the whole point of it, because that's the first act. Then the second act is all about how... John Hamm, who plays the FBI character, he gives a tip-off to Olivia Wilde, who's this like kind of sleazy journalist who then runs...
This has been getting a lot of flack in the press.
Yeah, and rightfully so, I think. Rightfully so. It's basically intimated in the story that she sleeps with him in order to get this story from John Hamm.
Right.
And I find that kind of hilarious because, number one, Olivia Wilde came out and said, look... I don't necessarily agree with that characterization. My understanding of it was that these two people already had a pre-existing sexual relationship. And that, this
was... Oh,
wasn't...
so that is true.
Well,
I thought it was full slander or whatever.
That's what they kind of indicated in the movie, I thought.
I didn't get that.
I picked up on it.
Did you?
Maybe you don't pick up on women's flirtatious ways. I don't know.
Clearly not.
That's what I was getting. I was getting that they had a prior romantic relationship. From the way they were talking to each other.
Yeah.
There was so much kind of...
Innuendo.
Yeah, yeah.
In
and kind
window.
Of... And, and camaraderie there, but kind of a little more than just friends,
yeah,
if
maybe.
You get what I mean.
But is the whole... It was slagged off because it's the idea that she's just doing it for her career and...
Yeah, that she was basically... The only way she could get ahead was having sex with John Hamm.
Right.
And then the third act is all about, the trial by media.
Spoilers?
Well, no, but like, I mean...
No,
it's,
I haven't seen it.
It's like, it was very simplistic. Like, I found it to be really, really simplistic.
So it becomes a lot clearer what he's trying to say with those kind
yeah.
of media... Right.
Exactly. It's sort of like, fuck you media for like dragging this innocent man through the gutter kind of thing. And all he was trying to do was help. But like... It doesn't delve into the fact that like Richard Jewell was a pretty complex guy to begin with, and he had like some there was a reason for that. Like there is no smoke without fire.
They like, had suspicion of him, like
completely. Like as in like he was cited plenty of times in his previous jobs for being overzealous with force and stuff like that.
But they do get into that with the whole campus thing.
Yeah, but like it's only
film.
At the start. It's only at the start, and then it's never mentioned again. It only comes back up at the end. Like I felt like they could have done it.
But I mean, they only have so long of a running time. What are they going to show you? An incident after incident,
No, but I mean, I think that they minimized. That's my point. I think they minimized people's concerns. I'm not saying they were right. It's not that. I just feel that it really did. Not give a full grasping of the scenario. I think it was quite simplistic. What did you think?
Well, I thought it was good because I thought it was really well acted. I thought Paul Walter Hauser was incredible. Sam Rockwell can just do no wrong. He's absolutely incredible.
Is
as
he an FBI man? Or?
He plays the lawyer, actually, that represents Richard Jewell. Watson Bryant is his name. I thought John Hamm was very good. Olivia Wilde, Kathy Bates, even though I don't know if she'd be kind of good enough or on screen enough to warrant that Oscar nomination.
You
but anyway,
saying,
she was
yeah.
very good. I thought that it really effectively established like a pre-9/11 world because I mean like when Richard is telling everyone to clear, get out of the way, that there's a threat to security, everyone's like, oh yeah, just sauntering along.
Yeah.
As opposed to like nowadays,
get
like
out.
People would be freaking the fuck out. So I thought that was really well done. I thought that like stylistically when that bomb goes off and everything and everyone's just so disorientated and trying to figure out what the hell's going on, where the hell they are, etc. I thought that was really well done. I just thought it was a really compelling story, really interesting and like well told. I mean, like, I don't know, like maybe I should have read a bit more into the backstory of it. I thought that it kind of worked and stood well in and of itself. I mean, I still gave it 3.5 stars. You know, I didn't give it a 5-star review.
No.
3.5 suggests it has its problems, but that it's generally entertaining and enjoyable. And that's what I thought about it. Like, I suppose for me, the biggest issue was I feel that Clint Eastwood as a director has kind of lost a lot of like... energy or something. I feel like he, when you're watching his party scenes, and I mean, this was the same for like the 1917 to Paris, the nightclub scene, and even like the house party scenes of The Mule. There's something about them that it feels like an old man is watching, is directing these scenes. Like,
and then
they just,
there will be a party.
They just don't have the energy and the chaos that they can. There's just something too kind of choreographed and staged, about them. So I thought that that was kind of a shame. So
what
that's
did
why
you guys
I thought, like,
Mule back in the day,
I think I gave it 3 stars.
Right.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Like, I mean,
was that a shock disappointment to you?
It wasn't a disappointment. The trailer for it was really good.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be like Breaking Bad. Cool. Wasn't that at all. It was more like closer to a comedy, if anything else.
I think I gave it 3.5. Yeah, it was kind of a comedy. But I still thought generally it worked. And again, that it was good fun, that I wouldn't be kind of urging people to go and see. The 1517 to Paris now is shocking. It's so bad.
It's so funny because he's so accomplished. Do you know what I mean? I mean, a lot's been talked of lately maybe about his conservative views coming to the fore. Maybe even American Sniper had its issues with its straightforwardness and that kind of thing.
Yeah, like I think I liked American Sniper.
It's a really good character study.
Yeah, character study. The action sequences were directed very, very well. I think if you take it as a technical exercise, leave out the politics of it. If you take it just as a technical achievement, it was done very, very well. And I thought it was a very, very good film. Now, when you immediately apply the lens of, okay, this exists in the real world where you're showing like American soldiers shooting dead kids and mothers and stuff like that, like then you're kind of like, oh, that's pretty fucked up. That's kind of true of a lot of his work. Like if you look back at something like, you know, Unforgiven, or if you look at...
I'm going way back now,
but like, you know, Pale Rider and stuff like that, like or Hang 'Em High or any of those films that he's done. Like there is that thing of like,
did he direct Hang 'Em High?
Are you sure he did?
Really?
Was that Don Siegel?
I didn't know he directed it.
Well, he did Pale Rider anyway. There was, what was that other one he did? Not fucking Outlaw. No, it wasn't Outlaw Joshua. I can't remember, but there was another one he did. But my point is that the films that he directs, they do, the minute you kind of apply a small amount of like, huh, what is this actually about? Then you're kind of like, oh, that's a little bit. But
yeah, like for Unforgiven, he kind of got that formula perfect with the whole like self-reflexive thing, like how it was a commentary on violence, how it was a commentary on kind of the genre of the Western itself, you know, like he kind of got that formula just right. And I would argue similarly with Gran Torino.
Gran Torino was... You can't come out of that going like, oh, he's a big racist. It's
I know that people have kind of, you know, criticized it for that sense, but I really think that that's just nonsense, honestly.
I think Gran Torino was such a brilliantly directed film. I loved Gran Torino. Why didn't he leave it there?
If that had been his swan song, that would have been the perfect note.
Did he direct Iwo Jima as well?
Yeah. Flags of Our Fathers and Ladders from Iwo Jima.
Yeah, both of them.
He did both of them. Like, I mean, fair play to him. Like, he is still, at his age, to be going full tilt the way he is. I mean, Jesus, fair going. But
I'd love to see another one from him.
I'd love to.
I had real high hopes for this. I mean, I still think it.
I still
I'll
think
enjoy
Richard
it.
Jewell is good and it's enjoyable, like I said. He has, I mean, another thing I would say, like just in his defense, because I mentioned the kind of, there's a slight lack of vitality in his movies or something. But I would also argue, just because you said, oh, simplistic and stuff like that, is that he does go about directing these stories very simply. Like you think of the 1517 to Paris, Sully, Richard Jewell. I think the whole idea of him kind of selecting these like kind of everyday, well, they're not quite everyday, but kind of American heroes who've done something extraordinary. I think that he sees the fact that he's making movies about them as putting them on enough of a platform itself that he doesn't need to make kind of a big action movie or a big compelling kind of crime drama or this other stuff around that fact, if
That's
you get
fair,
what I mean.
Yeah.
You know,
he has clearly chosen to do kind of American stories as opposed to, you know, he could revisit and try and make something like No Country for Old Men or
I mean, yeah, I think that he has put kind of the Western behind him. I kind of feel like Gran Torino was arguably his last Western.
Yeah.
If you look at it that way. It's very easy point. To,
yeah.
you know?
It's very, very, like, yeah, Gran Torino is, in the same way like Dirty Harry was like an urban Western. Mm-hmm. Like, I would put Gran Torino in the same category. I just think, you know, I understand what he's trying to do in this part of his life, that he's, you know, trying to understand.
Stay relevant mm-hmm. or?
No, not necessarily relevant, but I think the idea of, like, you know, the common man as a hero, you know, that sure. kind of thing, that yeah. like the common decencies, that sort of thing, like because Sully was all about that, like mm. he was just an airline pilot who was just, you know, trying his best.
Yes.
Richard Jewell, same thing as well, the guy who's just trying his best.
Yeah.
Chris Kyle in American Sniper, same thing. He was a guy who had this skill. He was a very violent, had a violent skill, but it was used earnestly and honestly.
Sure, like, yeah. Mm-hmm. They are all quite pure men.
Yeah, pure, yeah, that's yeah. it. Yeah, pure, that's it. Like, he is trying to achieve a purity. I don't know if it necessarily works, though. That's the thing. I don't necessarily think if it works, because that sort of black and white approach he takes, I don't know.
Do you think it's a bit intertwined with his patriotism or
no,
whatever?
No. Just in the sense of, like, that black and white is quite simplistic.
Right, yeah, yeah.
That nothing is black and white. Not in this day and age. Like, it just isn't, like. And while he may have the best intentions, I think the results don't necessarily line up to that. That's what I would say.
There you go. Well, that's what I wanted to hear. I wanted a Clint Eastwood chat, and I got one.
Yeah.
I do love Clint Eastwood, though. I will say that. I love Clint Eastwood. I think as a director, as an actor, I think he is the last of a breed. Like, there will never be another Clint Eastwood. Like,
yeah. I definitely would agree that on the whole black and white thing. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is no gray in Richard Jewell. He's very much the hero.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's never kind of doubted. But I still think generally it's a really fascinating story. Yeah. It's, like I said, well acted.
He makes entertaining films as well, I suppose.
I think they are entertaining. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's why I gave it 3.5.
I would have given it 2.5.
Really?
Really?
That's it. I would have given it 2.5.
Bang, I thought you were going to give it 3 last time I talked to you.
I know. See, that's it. When I walked out, it was like, yeah, that was okay. And then, like, I went away and had to think about it. And I talked to Paul Walter Hauser, which you'll hear the interview later on. And yeah, I came away from it and it was like, yeah, I don't know. It's just the more I thought about it, that's what I'm saying. The more you think about his later films, the more you're kind of like,
yeah, but you're not comparing it to his later films. You're talking about it in a movie.
I know,
but
that's what I'm saying. When I looked at his other films and then I looked at this, I was like, oh, yeah, that's kind of a recurring issue with him, I think.
Well, shall we tee up that interview?
Oh, are we done now? Have we done all the reviews? What's left? Queen and Slim.
You've seen
if
it.
If you want to talk about Queen and
briefly,
Slim.
Briefly.
We didn't have it there.
Briefly.
It's not on Owen's list, which I'm looking at.
Yeah, which we can see.
Has not been flagged.
Has not been flagged. I
Luckily
apologize.
For you, I saw the poster for it and I'm interested.
It's really, really good. It is Daniel Kaluuya. It is a fantastic road movie. Great soundtrack, really, really good. Definitely worth a watch. Very interesting story about race in America. Done in a...
It's an American production.
Yeah, but it's all English. It's all English actors. It's all English actors, but it's set in...
I presumed it was set in Britain.
No, it's set in America. No, it's set in like New Orleans and around that kind of general area. But it's a really, really well-directed film. Great, great soundtrack. Definitely worth a watch. So would recommend that as well. There you go. Now,
can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Just one. I hope this isn't true. I've seen the trailer and it looks like it gives away a lot, does it?
It does, yes.
Oh no.
It does. Well, like, no, I mean,
kind of like, I want to see like more, but I've got a feeling I know where this is going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair, because
the way you
teed up that question, Dee, I did not know why.
I was about to recircle
the hypocrite thing.
I mean, it's essentially Bonnie and Clyde, isn't
it? That's essentially, well, no, I mean,
hey guys, I haven't even seen the trailer. Now I'm like, wait a minute.
You saw the poster.
I know, I mean, to be fair, like what you're describing, it's essentially these two people meet for a Tinder date. And then they're driving
home. The modern day Bonnie and Clyde setup.
That's enough. Yeah, that's good.
But that's it. They're driving home, essentially. And he's dropping her back to her house kind of thing. Date has gone terribly. And they're just really, like, date went horrible.
Yeah.
And he gets pulled over by the cops. And then sure enough, you know, because they're both black and because it's in a, it's in Cleveland, and Cleveland does have a very, you know, he ends up shooting the cop in a scuffle. Like the cop basically pins him down and puts his knee on his back.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing of like, oh God, he's going to, it's, you know, that. And then the cop gets shot and they just take off.
Right.
And then it's them basically.
They're stuck together now.
They're stuck together and it's them sort of on the run. So it's, if anything, it's
more really interesting. Yeah.
It is. It's more closer to Bird on a Wire, I would think, that Goldie Hawn and Mel Gibson kind of thing. Mm. But it's really, really good though. It's definitely worth watching. The soundtrack is fucking fantastic. So,
oh my God, bro. Yeah,
definitely worth a watch.
Actually, I'm going to now check it out. We also have interviews for The Turning to get through.
Yes.
Will we or you know a bit more?
I
about
do.
Them. We've got
an interview marathon to come up after this.
We'll start with The Turning, because we'll just fly through these. So Finn Wolfhard talked a bit about the word film, which
he
did. A nice
yes,
plug for us.
We say it funny. Yeah. Apparently, Fiona Flynn, our TV editor, talked to Finn Wolfhard and Brooklyn Prince from The Turning. She talked to them like 2 years ago. By the way,
no way.
This was 2 years ago.
No.
Yeah.
This was while they were shooting the film, just to put this in context.
Crazy. Set busy, yeah. So the story was that John Carney apparently tipped off Finn Wolfhard about how Irish people say film. Seeing as this is the name of our show, here's that clip.
Yeah, and John's the best. And it's so funny, I was doing pre-production stuff with him and Oakes, who plays Theo in the movie, is the main kid. And he's from Dublin, and obviously did that movie, that incredible movie, Brooklyn. First part's set here, and the second part's obviously set in Brooklyn. And I told him I was going to shoot this thing, and he knew, and he was saying, get prepared for people to say film instead of film. And I was like, what? And he's like, film. And I was just like, okay, sure, man, I love it. And I came down here, and it was the best. I love everyone. And Ireland's so cool, man. Like, I haven't met one mean person in Ireland. I'm sure I will if I go to the right places, but I haven't met any bad people yet.
That's the name of our website's
what?
Movie podcast.
Yeah?
The Film Show.
The Film Show. Yeah. That's awesome.
F-I-L-U-M.
That's so awesome.
And then Fiona talked to Brooklyn Prince, who people will know from the Florida Project, talked about The Turning, talked about horror, and then talked about going to Johnny Fox's pub, which I've never been in.
What?
I've never been to Johnny Fox's.
Is it not on the way to Kildare?
It's no. It's like it's Wicklow. Where do you think Kildare is?
Left a bit.
Yeah, and Wicklow is south a bit.
They are a bit
down
less.
A bit.
Same. Come on.
Well, whatever, anyway. Brooklyn Prince, anyway, was in Johnny Fox's, so here's that clip.
The most wonderful experience I've had is probably here, because the Irish pubs and the live Irish music. I've always wanted to go to Ireland because I've listened to Irish music a couple times, and you know, I like their style and I like their accents, and I wanted to kind of see the way that their culture was, and I wanted to learn how to do the Irish jigs. So this is probably the best experience, because I went to Johnny Fox's pub, and let me just tell you, it was crazy.
I love Kildare.
Have you ever been in Kildare?
No.
Really?
No, I was brought there for the first time like 3 years ago or something.
Are you fucking serious?
I'd been to something in Maynooth, and I got taken to Naas, and I was like, wow.
Have you been in Kildare?
I don't know. I might have driven through it. I feel like I haven't actively visited it.
Charlotte, real quickly, have you been in Kildare? No.
Big no.
You people sicken me.
I know. I'd feel the same if it was Scaries.
I have been in Scaries.
I don't think I've been to Scaries.
I've been in Scaries.
Says a lot about Scaries.
And it's fine.
No!
There's a windmill.
I shouldn't have interrupted.
There's a windmill. Oh.
And two windmills.
Oh, there's two, isn't there?
And a west-facing harbour on the east coast.
Anywho,
speaking of Ireland, how about Dublin Lighthouse Cinema, which is what?
All right,
oh, yeah.
That was a good deal.
Get there,
no,
get there.
You're that, yeah.
Which
now
is
wait,
what?
We have to preface this. There is no lighthouse in the lighthouse.
Yeah,
cinema.
I kind of messed this up, but I mean, I really appreciated how Robert Pattinson thought there was. I thought that was kind of adorable. Yeah, I didn't.
I didn't
explain the Lighthouse Cinema very well at all. But I mean, then we had a laugh about it, and now I can say I had a laugh with Robert Pattinson, which is pretty cool.
And he's gonna have a really confusing trip to the Jemison Distillery someday.
I thought this was a Lighthouse.
That's really nice. He'll come to visit now.
Yeah,
I set that up. But yeah, here's our interview. So we talk about that. We talk about just. I wanted to say. This movie is batshit crazy, but I wasn't sure if I was allowed to curse. So you can hear me say it's insane and madness.
Just cursed.
I literally just wanted to say it's batshit crazy. And how the fuck do you get into a role like that? I wanted to say that, but I phrased it a little more eloquently. And then at the end, we reflected on his career choice and how he has come, you know, from, you know, Twilight and indie movies and stuff like that back to something like The Batman. So here it is. Hey, Robert, how are you today?
I'm good. How you doing?
Good. You know what's funny? There's actually a Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin, and that's where I ended up seeing the movie.
Is it in a lighthouse?
It was a lighthouse.
So it's an unusual shape for a cinema.
Yeah, well, it's still kind of outside. It's kind of nice. It has a bit of ambiance to it, you know?
Cool.
Gives
nice.
It a bit of something.
Nice.
So I really enjoyed the film, although if I do say so myself, it was quite, like, it was insane. It was just genuinely the maddest film I'm probably going to end up seeing all year. Like, when you get the script for a film like this, are you ever looking at it going like, this has gone too mad, too far, or are you just all willing to jump right into it?
I mean, it was so beautifully written, and that you're kind of like, yeah, this is like great, but tonally it had so many different things going on, but you're kind of like, is this going to hold together? Like, I mean, is it just, because I mean, sometimes you make something that's too strange and people are just like, ah, I don't get this. It's like, this is like too arty, whatever. And it's like, I'm so happy it doesn't really come across as like just hardcore art house. It's actually kind of like, it's very like visceral and sort of, I don't know, it's not like a difficult watch, I mean, in terms of it being boring or whatever. It's really exciting.
And you have a really interesting character in it who is kind of descending into madness. What kind of like physical and mental preparation goes into getting ready for that film?
I think there's like a part of me that just, as soon as you see, like, there's a couple of the monologues at the end. Well, there's one part which I really liked when they get so drunk that my character doesn't know if he is him or the person he's talking to. And I was like, that's kind of interesting. I was like, I've never been that drunk before. Like, what does that feel like when you drink yourself into a total existential crisis? And like, there are just kind of elements, I don't know, it always seems appealing the more extreme a character's behavior is. So yeah. It's always fun because there's no upper limit on how crazy you can go.
Like, I was getting really strong, and this might be me being kind of a film geek here, but I was getting kind of vibes of Andrei Tarkovsky, even like kind of old silent black and white movies. Would you have watched any films like that kind of to prepare you for the role?
I mean, I do like Tarkovsky movies. It's kind of, I hadn't really watched anything as such. I mean, I'd watched a few things about, just for the accent, these different lobster fishermen in Maine. Mm. And then I was just kind of practicing the accent, and then I just noticed there was a mirror in front of me when I was doing it, and it made your face go into this weird thing, and it just kind of, I didn't even know what it was really reminding me. It didn't really remind me of movies, but I just kind of knew. I was like, oh, there's something in that. It was all just sort of from this strange accent. And that's kind of pretty much all the prep was, just contorting her face to make these syllable sounds.
What was your experience of working with Willem Dafoe? Because obviously, you know, it is a two-hander between you guys, and you just have such an intense kind of relationship. It's really palpable.
I've been a massive fan of Willem. I mean, I think he's amazing. He's kind of, there's so many of my favorite performances. His performance in like Wild at Heart is like one of my favorite things I've ever seen. And like, I didn't really know exactly what to expect, but then we did a day of rehearsal and I was like, wow, well, it's so specific. I never would have thought that's a part that he would want to play. And when you see him in character and it's like, you look born to play this part. Like his face, it's like, he looks like he must have been, like he was that in another life somewhere.
Amazing. I suppose my last question then for you, Robert, like you've been making some really, really interesting career choices really across the years, but especially recently between indie features like this, but you're looking to franchises as well. Has this all been kind of a conscious plan or has it just kind of worked out the way it has?
Just the way it has. I mean, I've always just gone, you know, you try and find interesting directors to work with them and you know, you kind of think, oh, this looks like it'll be fun. I mean, and also you kind of try and do the opposite to what you've done before, try and find new facets to stuff you can do and try and keep it interesting for yourself. I mean, yeah.
Well, we'll leave it there. We're so excited to see what's next then.
Thank you.
I also wrote a Robert Pattinson deep dive feature, on entertainment.ie, in which I talk about this is how Robert Pattinson ended up going from Twilight to The Lighthouse. And I totally embedded like my interview and stuff. It is in the movie news section.
Yes, on entertainment.ie.
And it's quite an interesting like exploration. Like when you really kind of look at it, he's actually had over the last like decade or so a really, really, really interesting career. Like he's really kind of been very precise and thoughtful about about every role that he's done.
The funniest.
And you guys have to go watch Good Time. I checked. It's still on Netflix.
I will do it.
So, so good.
I did see Uncut Gems, though.
How about fucking Uncut Gems?
Actually, you know what? We can talk about that because that's on Netflix from this Friday. There you go. Yeah, 31st.
We'll put it in next week.
We'll put it in next week.
People a little teasy tease.
Oh, well,
tease
we already reviewed it. But I mean, say what you thought about
it again. Yeah, okay. Once people can see it.
Oh, okay. I get what you mean.
Because we've all
seen
it.
Post-review review. Yeah.
Okay, why not? Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
I'm on the podcast.
Good save. Yeah, exactly. All right. Final interview. Paul Walter Hauser. Talk to him over the phone. This sound quality is not great.
Brian.
I recorded this right next to a train. Not even joking. So...
This, was this because you were working on the railroad? Dude,
you know what that is, by the way? What? That's a simplistic approach, much like Clint Eastwood used for Richard Jewell. So it all comes around again.
Hypocrite. Let's roll the clip.
Hey, is this Brian?
Paul, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, man. How you doing?
Not too bad. First off, congratulations on the film. I mean, I saw it yesterday, and I have to say, it was a really... it felt like a very... authentic performance, and I suppose my first question I wanted to ask you was I know Clint is kind of known for giving very very minimal direction and he only does like a couple of takes, but I suppose what was the kind of the recurring direction that you got from him?
Thank you for the compliment, man. As far as Clint directing, the most consistent thing he told me was to put on a little bit of weight, and he told me to pace up my performance. He wanted me to look like Richard Jewell, and he wanted me to get to the point, because sometimes I tend to rant and ramble, and I improvise a lot. So he liked the performance, but he was always trying to push us all to get to the point and try to be expedient while telling the story.
I mean, I get that part of it, but I guess my question would be like, as in, you know, did he want you to kind of internalize a lot of it? Because there's only really one scene in it, that great scene with you and Sam Rockwell, when Sam Rockwell kind of says like, why aren't you so angry? You know, why aren't you so angry? And then, you know, Richard explodes and he's all like, I'm angry and angry. I mean, was he telling you to keep it all in, that kind of rage inside? Or, I mean, how did that kind of work? Like,
That wasn't direction so much as it was just, the matter-of-fact screenplay. The screenplay portrayed him as someone who was very passive and very respectful, and he sort of wouldn't stick up for himself. It was like he was being bullied, and he felt that it was weirdly justifiable or okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just internalized that as an actor. I looked at it and I went, because in real life, I do have, you know, a justice tick, and I do have rage, and I do have pieces of me that would never tolerate one-tenth of what Richard went through. I would have probably been in jail for, you know, punching a reporter or something. So I Richard's a better man than me, plain and simple. He underwent such insane scrutiny and was so treated so unfairly. The fact that he handled it the way he did, I think, is remarkable. And so there are moments where in intense situations, if you rewatch the film, you'll notice me bouncing my knee a little bit.
Yeah.
And I allowed that tick to show up to show that, you know, he's not boiling, but there's a simmer. And then, of course, it boils over in the scene you just discussed with myself and Sam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What was it like working with Sam? Because, I mean, I know you have a comedy background, and Sam, I know he does dramatic work, but he's kind of, his best roles are kind of comedic. I mean, did the two of you kind of bounce off any ideas about, like, I don't know, adding a bit of levity to it, or?
I think it's natural because Sam and I are both just funny people. Funny's funny, and I think Jack Nicholson is the same way, where, like, Jack Nicholson can do a drama, and he was still hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
There are just pieces of him that end up in the film. So I think Sam and I were trying to be authentic and true to it, but also when you know there's a piece of comedy that's still grounded, we definitely leaned into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the scene where we have the artillery laid out on my bed.
Yeah.
You know, that was a moment where we were almost breaking character because
the scene
is funny. You know, it's darkly ironic and unfortunate and funny, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's very, I mean, well, I suppose, I mean, obviously, maybe you did research or maybe you didn't, I don't know, but I mean, what was the most surprising thing you learned about Richard throughout playing the role and before you took on the role? What was the most surprising thing you learned about him?
I think I was most surprised by the sort of naivete that resided in his idealism. He was sort of this Boy Scout type who had the greatest of intentions, but had poor execution and maybe a lack of self-awareness.
Yeah.
So I think I can relate to that in a way where I'm painfully self-aware nowadays at the age of 33.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that as recent as 5 or 6 years ago, I had a lot of lack of self-awareness. And it led to, you know, some moments of fumbling and idiocy. So, you know, I think I was surprised to find out how overly idealistic and hopeful he was and how that naivete played into his moments of demise that we highlight in the film.
I mean, it's kind of, there is something, I mean, obviously, you know, the tragedy, if you like, of it is that he did actually have, like, he did have the best of intentions, but people were just sort of taking advantage of him. Like, I mean, is there an element of, like, I don't know, sort of taking advantage? Like, do you feel that kind of, like, you know, rage, I guess, or something like that in his performance? Like, I mean, I know we kind of talked about that already, like, but I would just think, like, if with somebody like this who is so well-meaning, the fact that they're being taken advantage of, it's kind of hard to not have your own opinion on it, like.
Well, you know, I would say my opinion is that I share the patience in the pain in some way, where as an actor, you have to go on all these auditions, you have to take classes, you have to study and read books and watch films, you have to travel, you have to sometimes make your own short films or put up your own theater show to find money to put up a short film or a theater show. You have to find people who would work for free for the theater or film. Like, it's not one thing. Trying to be a great actor takes a lot in a lot of ways you don't even intend.
Yeah.
So amidst all that, eating all this crap and trying to fight your way to being a working actor, you do have to have patience knowing I'm doing this to get to the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
And I think Richard, in all the hoopla that happened with Richard, he was probably, I have to assume he was thinking to himself, I will keep eating all this crap and I'll put up with all this stuff because I know that at the end of the day, they'll see that I'm innocent. But it was 88 days of being under the scrutiny of the public eye. So I have to imagine that after a while, your patience does wear thin and you're starting to break.
Yeah.
So when you see footage or photos of Richard crying in public and sort of like holding his hands over his face,
yeah,
you know, it breaks my heart seeing a man be broken down like that, trying to do the right thing and trying to not be explosive.
And, yeah.
For lack of a better word, no pun intended. But I know that in my situation, if I were him, I probably would have been explosive. I probably would have crashed.